It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, several big-ticket provisions in Governor Evers' proposed budget were cut by the legislature's budget committee along party-line votes. We'll learn more about the vote and what it could mean for the budget moving forward. First, it's Food Friday, and we're feeling just peachy about it. Not only is that because the sun is finally out, but we're going to talk about cooking with some of nature's candy, the peach. Your mind may go immediately to peach cobbler, canned peaches, or even peach brandy. But our next guest says the peach is much more versatile to cook with than you might think. Belinda Smith-Sullivan is a chef, food writer, and spice blends entrepreneur, and she's got a new cookbook out called Just Peachy. Belinda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, what inspired you to write a cookbook focused on the peach?
Well, first of all, I live in Edgefield County, South Carolina, which is the peach capital of the South.
Ah.
Now, I know you might think Georgia is, but it's really South Carolina.
We know all about regional differences, shall we say, up here. So I can appreciate that. So you're surrounded by not just peaches, I'm guessing, but peach culture.
Absolutely. It's like living in the middle of an orchard.
Wow. Well, you write in your book about spending a lot of time on your grandparents' farm and canning peaches. Tell us more about that deep and long connection you have to the fruit.
Well, we used to spend all of our summers in Mississippi on my grandparents' farm. And all my grandmother did during the summer, it seemed at the time, you know, when you're a small child, was to can peaches and preserve peaches, and my grandfather made peach brandy. So it was a lot of fun for a small child at that time. And that love that I developed for peaches just never left me. And then years later, I would move to Edgefield County in South Carolina and discovered where I was really living. And just became obsessed with them and just started experimenting with a lot of different recipes using the peach.
Well, I'm guessing, too, that a fruit that has such a delicate skin and is ripened on the tree, that you probably get a lot of peaches in a very short amount of time. And so you have to do a lot of things with them quickly.
That's absolutely correct. And, again, we are just... Oh, goodness, just inundated with them all summer. And as you said, I mean, I personally can't go to a peach stand and buy one or two peaches. I usually buy a half a bushel and bring them home. And I have to admit, I eat half, and then the other half I have to use.
Well, before we talk about using, talking about eating them fresh, I know that some people peel peaches before eating them and some don't. I'd love to know where you come down on that.
I eat it right, you know, the way it is. I don't peel them before eating. I peel some of them when I'm making certain dishes or in applications, but for eating, no. And I would prefer not to even peel them. For instance, when I make my peach pie, I do not peel the peaches.
Mm,
but and it's a personal preference.
Yeah. All right. Well, you write about perfecting some of your mother's and grandmother's recipes, but you also say that no matter what, they never come out tasting just like when they made them. I think that is something that we can all relate to, trying to create those flavors, especially of childhood. What do you think it is about these peach recipes that are so hard for you to get exactly right?
Well, I think I was talking about my mother and my grandmother's peach pie, and over the years, I've experimented, and, you know, let me try this, let me try that. But again, mine never seemed to taste quite like theirs. And I sometimes wonder if it's just psychological. Mm. You know, mine are good. I'll have to brag about myself and say that they are good. But when I close my eyes and I think about my mother and my grandmother's peach pies and peach cobblers, there's just something there that's missing for me.
We're talking with Belinda Smith-Sullivan. She's a chef, food writer, and spice blends entrepreneur, and her new cookbook is Just Peachy. And Belinda, when is peach season exactly?
Well, in my county, this week, the growers just started picking this Monday, and they'll be flooding the market this weekend.
And how long does it last?
We go from mid-May to about mid-September.
Mm.
Now, in the more northern states, I know that the season starts a little later, but we always have peaches just before Memorial Day in my area.
Well, and as you said, we do tend to think of peaches as being from the southeast in those states, but you just also mentioned the northern growing season. How far spread is peach cultivation in the U.S.?
Peaches are grown in the 48 contiguous states.
Really?
The only two states in the U.S. where there are no peaches are obviously Alaska and Hawaii.
I'm really surprised because I do think of them as needing really hot summers, but maybe there are different cultivars that can do better in our northern climates up here?
Absolutely, absolutely. And even in the South, you think, as you mentioned, you need really, really warm weather. We need to get X number of freezing days, even in our area, in order for the peaches to really develop their good flavor.
Wow. Well, that's news to me. And so I know this is probably politically a very sensitive question, being where you are, but other than right in your area, where are the best peaches?
Well, you just said it.
I've heard Colorado peaches are very good. Is that something you've heard as well?
You know, I'm not familiar with their peaches. Now, I know New Jersey and Pennsylvania have very good peaches as well.
Wow.
Yes.
So they do come from all over the country.
From all over the country.
Well, when we're at a grocery store, maybe a farm stand, and there are those gorgeous looking peaches, mm-hmm. what do we need to look for to make sure that they're great tasting peaches when we choose them?
Oh, I don't know if there's a surefire way of doing that, but you want to look for peaches that are firm but not hard. You want to look at the color, that it's consistent. Those are the two things that I look at, and I actually smell them.
And is that smelling at the stem end?
I'm sorry, could you say again?
Do you smell it at the stem end like you might do, say, for a melon?
Yes, yes. And if it smells like a peach, then chances are that the flavor is going to be there, you know, that sugar content. If it doesn't smell like a peach, I probably wouldn't purchase that one.
And peaches are a fruit that I think of as being pretty delicate, easily bruised. Are they often picked before they're ripe so that they do have a little more hardness to them to protect them? Is that something we need to make sure that we're not getting one that was picked too early?
The growers do pick them before they're at the heart of you know, ripeness, mm-hmm. ripeness. They pick them, they're taken to the shed, they're immediately rinsed, and they're defuzzed, and then they're shipped to the supermarket. They usually, from the time they're picked to the time they get to the supermarket, is only about 3 days. And during those 3 days, they do have an opportunity to ripen a little bit. You will find when you shop for them in the supermarket, there are going to be some that are less ripe than others. And that's kind of done on purpose, too, so that they don't rot while they're in the supermarket. But when you're choosing them to take home with you, you want to get those that are a little bit more ripe than unripe.
Let's go to the phones. And Nancy in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. As a child, I ate the pickled peaches that my mother made. And I thought they were just wonderful. And I would like you to discuss how to possibly make them.
Wow. So, Nancy, I have to ask you, I've never heard of pickled peaches. What do they taste like?
Well, the liquid is something similar to what you would taste with a pickled beet.
Hmm.
It's sweet and sour. But I don't know the ratio of sugar to vinegar.
Wow. Well, thanks for introducing me to that, Nancy. And Belinda, is pickling peaches something that you've done?
Well, Nancy, you got me at an advantage here, too, because I have not had pickled peaches myself. And it's, not a recipe that I have in the book. And I'm afraid to tell you that I'd have to do some more research on that.
Wow. Well, I'm guessing, Belinda, that you're going to be doing that soon. Nancy, if you have a recipe or any kind of idea of it, send it along to us at ideas@wpr.org. And I have to say, Belinda, I am not surprised that someone from Milwaukee was pickling peaches, because with all the Poles and Germans here in Wisconsin, we pickle just about anything.
But I tell you, it sounds excellent. I mean, I'd love to try that myself.
Are there a lot of different varieties of peaches out there, Belinda? And are there some that are better for different types of dishes?
Yes, there are several varieties. If you'll look in my book, first of all, there are three basic varietals of peaches. There are the early peaches that we call clingstones. There are the mid-season peaches that are semi-freestone, which means they pull away easily from the from the stone. And then there are the late season that are just totally freestone peaches. The early peaches, the clings, are good for like eating and canning. The semi-freestones are good for baking and pickling, Nancy. They're good for pickling. And the late season peaches are good for grilling. If you've ever had grilled peaches on, say, you know, a side of a steak or a pork chop or something like that, those are the ones. They're really hardy. They hold up to the grilling process. But there are several hundreds of varietals of peaches.
We're talking with Belinda Smith Sullivan right now. She's a chef, food writer, and spice blends entrepreneur. And she has a new cookbook out. It is called Just Peachy. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite dish to cook that uses peaches? What questions do you have about cooking with peaches? Are you a canner? Do you have a question for Belinda about using peaches in maybe unusual ways? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we continue the conversation about cooking with peaches with Chef Belinda Smith Sullivan. Her new cookbook is titled Just Peachy. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite memory about eating or cooking something with peaches? Did your parents or grandparents use that fruit in their cooking? Have you had any good peaches yet this year? And what peachy questions do you have for our guest about cooking with that delicious fruit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, of course, fresh peaches are divine, Belinda, but there's a lot of the year when that's just not an option, especially up here in the north. Sure. Are frozen peaches ever a good substitute for fresh peaches?
They are the best substitute for fresh peaches. Absolutely.
And what about canned peaches?
You can use canned peaches are very good in peach pies. But if it's something I'm going to cook on the stove or bake, I will I prefer to use the frozen peaches.
Is that a matter of texture mostly?
Yes, it's a matter of texture. If you have access to peaches during the summer, which you do, and if you want to spend the time, you can freeze your own peaches so that you have them throughout the year, and that's what I do. As we're coming to the end of the peach season, when all of the great freestones are available, I take them home, a couple of bushels, and I'll spend a day or two just freezing them.
And how do you do that? What's the process so we know what to do when we get all those great peaches in the summer?
It's a lot easier than you think. What I do is, and I prepare them different ways. I will peel some. I will not peel others. I will have them. I will slice some. I will just chop some. And what I do is I spread them out on a parchment-lined sheet pan and stick them in the freezer for about 4 hours, let them get hard, and then I put them in Ziplocs or in the vacuum-sealed bags.
And that's
it? That's it. It's so easy.
That does sound easy.
Yes, and that way you, and the reason I freeze them first before I bag them is that they're loose, and you can just use as many or as few as you want or as you need.
Well, let's get to some recipes because my mouth is watering just thinking about peaches, but now I want to know how to cook with them. So first of all, in your book, Just Peachy, where did you draw from to compile all these recipes?
It's something that I've been working on since I moved to our area about 18 years ago. As I said, during the summer, every summer, I would just experiment with different peaches and develop recipes for my own use. And then after culinary school, I had amassed so many recipes, I said, you know, I think this would make a good book. When I was doing my own experiment, I couldn't find a peach cookbook that would give me all of the resources that I needed, how to can, how to freeze, how to do this, how to do that. And so it's something that I just had to work at compiling trial and error by myself. And I thought just maybe someone else could, you know, is one looking for this information and can use it. And so that is how the book came about.
Well, Belinda, I want to get to your recipes, but I love our WPR listeners. We have someone who has some information about pickled peaches on the line. So let's go to Steve from Madison. Hi, Steve.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. Happy that you called in to tell us about pickled peaches.
Well, first off, a question for your guest. I missed hearing where she is from, where her peach growing expertise is.
Belinda?
South Carolina, Edgefield County.
Oh, South Carolina. Okay. Yeah, definitely had good peaches from South Carolina. Well, I grew up in Southern California, 1960s, and there were the town I lived in, we didn't grow them commercially, but they had been growing a lot in the area, lots of peach orchards and walnut. And we had several trees on our property, and my mom did do the pickling of the peaches. And aside from the discussions of the sugar, vinegar, I can't give you proportions at all, but there was one key ingredient that made them super special, and that is that she would peel the whole peaches and then stick whole cloves into the meat of the peach. And so what you got was this really cool combination of the peach flavor plus that warm, spicy note from the cloves. That's one of my real strong memories about my mom's pickled peaches, and I wish we had recipes for it. But I remember that one of the yellow peach varieties that we had, she described as Alberta with a E-L.
Yes.
Yeah,
a very good peach.
Thank you so much for that, Steve. So it sounds, Belinda, like we'll still have to play around with the proportions of vinegar and sugar, but putting, you know, studding those peaches with cloves is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. And that goes so well. Remember you asked me about varietals?
Yes.
And I mentioned the late season peaches, the Freestone.
Yes.
Albertas are Freestone peaches. So, and they're very hearty, and they hold up to the flavor of the cloves.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for giving us more information on that. Belinda, I want to talk about your recipe for blackberry peach buckle, and that recipe is up at WPR.org/Food Friday, so we can all try it. Tell us about that recipe.
The buckle is, first of all, I have a section called Just Pies. Most people just think a pie is a pie is a pie. Well, pies have a history. And the buckle is what I call the almost forgotten pie in America. It was the precursor to it's a precursor to one of the early pies that the settlers brought over. And again, it's a combination almost of a cake and a pie, because you put in the pan, you put the fruit on the bottom, you pour the layer of cake on the top, and as it cooks, the fruit rises up through the dough and ends up on top of it.
Ah,
yeah.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's a very impressive dessert to make. The coffee cake, that was what I was trying to think of. It's the precursor to the what we know today is called coffee cake.
Well, certainly we think of peaches and other fruits as being in sweet recipes, but peaches especially can be really good in unexpected savory dishes. And you actually have a recipe that is also up at WPR.org/Food Friday for spinach peach omelet. That is a very unusual combination.
It seems as if some of the recipes in which I use peaches are strange. But if you think about the flavor profile that's going on there, spinach is somewhat bitter, and the peaches just helps to round out that flavor. And it's almost like it's packaged inside of a little, you know, egg roll, so to speak. So, yeah, the flavor is amazing. And the flavor profile is, I think, one that you'd find quite unique.
I actually am very intrigued by that. I'm going to have to try that. I have had dishes with a variety of fruits in them that are meat-based. What advice do you have for pairing meats with peaches?
Well, there are several entrees in the book. For instance, peach-stuffed pork chops. Peaches pair very, very well with pork chops. It's almost like it's a marriage made in heaven. They go very well with your baked or stewed chicken dishes. I even pair them grilled with steaks. So they're just oh my goodness, salmon and with a, say, like a...
some kind peach, of a sauce?
With a peach relish.
Ah. Yeah. Well, and Chris on Facebook said that she likes using peach chutney with baked chicken or pork. So that kind of fits in with what you're describing as well.
Mm-hmm. Peach chutney. Chutneys and relishes are nice because they have those other, the aromatics in them, like the onions and bell peppers and things like that. Yeah. That, again, marry very well with the peach flavor.
So, Belinda, I have to ask you about one recipe that you have, peach guacamole. How did you come up with that?
Well, about 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to make a peach mango guacamole. An avocado mango guacamole. And it just seemed natural to me to come next, that if mango went very well with avocado, then surely, peaches would as well.
Wow. Well, that too sounds really intriguing. And I could see the peach kind of cutting some of the richness of a traditional avocado guacamole as well.
Yes. Now, it will be, because of the texture of the peach, it's not going to be as smooth as some people would prefer their guacamoles. I happen to prefer my guacamole chunky, and that's exactly what you get when you marry the avocado with the peach. You're going to get that chunkiness.
One quick question before we have to let you go. Mm-hmm. When you're grilling peaches, like you said, to go next to something like a steak, how are you preparing it before putting it on the grill?
I don't put anything on mine. I just have it. I make sure that I oil the surface of the grill so that the peach doesn't stick, and just put it right on the surface, on the grate.
Well,
and you can do that either quartered or just half them.
Half is probably better for not losing it between the grate.
There you go. And I definitely would not peel them.
All right. Yeah, to hold it together too. Belinda, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to talk with you today.
You too, Judith. Thank you so much for having me.
We talked with Chef Belinda Smith-Sullivan about her new cookbook, Just Peachy, and all the different and sometimes unexpected ways we can cook with the fruit. The legislature's Budget Committee voted 11-4 this week to remove several provisions in Governor Evers' proposed budget, including Medicaid expansion and a plan to legalize marijuana. The vote was along party lines, with GOP lawmakers in favor of removing portions of the budget and Democrats opposing the move. All in all, the committee removed more than 130 provisions from the budget and created a significant funding gap. Patrick Marley is a state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me here.
First, can you tell us a little more about the Budget Committee's considerations and vote this week?
Sure. The governor introduced his budget in February, and immediately Republicans who control the legislature said that they did not like major portions of it, and they carried through with what they've been saying this week by taking out really the centerpieces of his budget, the things that he had championed the most and campaigned on, the biggest example of that being the Medicaid expansion. They took those out, and now they'll spend the next weeks sort of rebuilding the budget in many ways from ground up to send him their own plan, which he will then have a chance to sign or veto or veto in part.
So as we said, Medicaid expansion was taken out, also the plan to legalize medical marijuana, but with 130 provisions being removed, what are some of the others that were taken out by the committee?
Yeah, there's a lot of things there that Democrats and Governor Evers said that they really saw as very important. So some other examples would be redistricting reform, sort of create a nonpartisan system for establishing where congressional districts and legislative districts are. I have to think here about some of the other provisions we had. I'm blanking. I'm sorry.
That's no problem.
The dark store loophole that is something that critics call it, which is how we assess big box retailers. He wanted to change that so that the retailers would not be able to get away with paying lower property taxes. The driver's licenses for people who are in the country illegally is something that was also in his budget that the Republicans took away. So there was a series of things like that that Republicans saw as a liberal wish list and that Democrats said were essential parts of his plan.
Republican State Representative John Nygren of Marinette spoke about the budget vote. Here's what he had to say.
We don't believe that it's a time to change course, to go back to the days of deficit spending, of large tax increases.
Again, that was Republican State Representative John Nygren. He's also the co-chairperson of the Joint Finance Committee, that budget committee we were talking about. So he's talking about it's not time to go back to the days of deficit spending or large tax increases. Patrick, were most of these provisions that were removed at least in what the GOP was saying their reasons were because of the fiscal impact? Or, as you said, was it more that these are liberal wish list items and that's why we're going to say no?
So it's a mix of the two. So like the example I gave of the redistricting reform doesn't have any kind of fiscal effect or any meaningful fiscal effect. They say that should be handled as standalone legislation. No Republicans oppose those changes. So that's the reason they took that out. But other things have a major fiscal effect. For instance, $1 billion in tax changes that the governor was recommending. He wanted to increase taxes on manufacturers and on capital gains. Republicans said that they weren't going to do that because they thought that was bad for the economy. They took that out. The Medicaid expansion would have had a positive fiscal effect for the state and allowing the state to free up $320 some million of state taxpayer money that could be used for health care or other purposes. So when you sort of look at the whole, you know, there's 130 some items. Many of them do have a fiscal element. Some of them, it's common for governors of both parties to put non-fiscal things in budgets, and it's common for the lawmakers of the other party to call that a bad idea. And so those were included in some of the things that came out.
We're talking with Patrick Marley right now. He's a state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And as you said, Patrick, Medicaid expansion was a big part of what was cut. It was also a big part of the platform that Governor Evers ran on last year. There have been polls that show that there is quite a bit of support in Wisconsin for that Medicaid expansion. What did the GOP say about why they were cutting that from the budget?
So their main concern about the Medicaid expansion is they believe that it will drive up the cost of insurance for people who are on the private market. They say that the people who would get onto Badger Care Plus is about 82,000 people already have access, in some cases through the Obamacare exchanges, to get insurance, that they would be better off doing that than having the state expand its Medicaid program.
And what kind of financial impact on the budget does the removal of the Medicaid expansion have?
So it's about $324 million of state money. So the reason this Evers and other Democrats back this idea is because the federal government will pay a much larger share of the Medicaid program when you expand it because you're bringing it to newly eligible people. And so the state would draw in more than $1 billion in federal money, and then that would free up state money that otherwise is going to have to go toward the Medicaid program. So that creates more of a problem for Republicans as they draft their version of the budget because they're not going to be able to do all the things that Evers wanted to do because there's this money they're going to have to funnel into health care to keep us with our current system, and then there's the tax increases that they're not taking. So that's why we have this $1.4 billion difference between what the governor wanted to do and sort of the money available for Republicans to work with.
So what have we heard from Governor Evers about this vote by the Joint Finance Committee?
So he has criticized it greatly and said he doesn't think this is the end of the road, that he believes the public is on his side, and he does have some polling to back that up, that he's urging people to call their lawmakers to get them to change course. Lawmakers say that hasn't really worked, that they haven't heard from a lot of people, and when they do hear from people, they're not necessarily in their districts. So far the Republican lawmakers are saying they're not really swayed by that. But the governor has contended that he has the upper hand rhetorically and believes that he can persuade them to take this deal.
This is a Joint Finance Committee. While the GOP has the majority, there are Democratic members on it. What did we hear from Democratic members of the committee about the vote?
They were very critical of it. I think, you know, very much in line with the governor. I think the one interesting part of this is that, you know, they really put all of their focus on the Medicaid expansion, the use of the Affordable Care Act money to expand Badger Care. There are dozens of other things here that they want, like automatic voter registration, raising the age at which you charge teens as adults for crimes from 17 to 18, the big box store change that I mentioned. Those are all really important to Democrats, but they have kind of talked less about that so they can focus all of their energy on this Medicaid expansion, which, again, Republicans have been very strongly opposed to.
So these are all part of a very large budget bill. Could any of these provisions that have been cut by the Joint Finance Committee maybe become standalone bills to try to get them passed in through a different channel?
They could try that, but it really seems, you know, whether you're passing it as a budget or as a standalone bill, it's got to go through a Republican-controlled legislature. And if they don't like it in the budget, they're not going to be too amenable to it as standalone legislation. So, you know, I think that if Democrats are going to be able to get something, it probably still is through the budget process because, you know, this is the very first vote of the Joint Finance Committee. They're going to spend weeks working on this. Then it's going to go to the floors of the Assembly and the Senate. They could change their mind on this or any other issue. I mean, I'm just saying theoretically. The Republican leaders have been very strongly saying they're not going to reverse course, but you know, Democrats do have an opportunity to influence the process since they hold the governor's office.
We have certainly heard a lot from the GOP about what they wanted to see taken out of Governor Evers' proposed budget. Have we heard much about what they want to see in or changes that they want to make? It sounds like they've been more vocal about what they want to change from his plan.
Yeah, that's true. We haven't heard really a lot of specifics about what they want to do. You know, for instance, the governor proposed increasing school funding by $1.4 billion. Republicans have said they support adding some amount, giving schools an increase, but they haven't given us any idea of what amount of money they might put into that. They say it's too early. They need to see as they go through the budget process, how much money they have available. It's clearly going to be a lot less than the governor wanted because they think that the $1.4 billion is too big of an increase for taxpayers. And the other great unknown, I think, is transportation, which has been an issue in recent years that has really split Republicans. The governor here has recommended an 8-cent per gallon gas tax increase, and Assembly Republicans have been pretty supportive of the idea of a gas tax increase or another revenue enhancer, maybe not that big, but some kind of additional money for roads. Republicans in the Senate have been very resistant to that. That issue delayed the last state budget by about 3 months. It remains to be seen whether they can find some kind of an agreement that they can even send to Governor Evers.
And Patrick, as we wrap up, what will you be watching for as this budget process moves forward?
Well, I mean, I think that's the main question is that we have been hearing from Republicans for weeks about their opposition to Evers' plans and why they thought it was a bad plan. Now they've got to build their own and show us what that is. And with this big difference between what Evers had put forward in terms of spending and what Republicans have said they're going to set it at, which is sort of an inflationary increase rather than maybe an 8% increase that Evers had looked at. What do they do that Evers wasn't going to do? You know, how much do they put into schools? How do they address health care given that they're not taking this additional federal money? Those are the sort of main things that I and other reporters are going to be looking at for the foreseeable future.
Well, Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Patrick Marley is a state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about the state of Governor Evers' proposed budget. A new report finds seniors in Wisconsin are being scammed out of hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Here's one example of a real-life solicitation that one of our producers actually received, and we should note that it's edited for time and to cover up some information.
I promised you that information about bringing in $10,000 or more every 10 to 14 days. So I'm just going to leave this here on your voicemail so you have it. But if you can, just write this down. www.com. goats.com. Let me spell that for you. .com. Goats, check it out as soon as you can. Trust me, you'll be very happy you did. Even retirees are doing well here.
So that, again, was a scam phone call message that one of our producers received. We bleeped out the website because we didn't want anyone to think we were sending them there. Our next guest says that there are a number of different ways that scams are sent to people and that they fall victim to, but there are ways to protect yourself and your loved ones. Tiffany Bernhardt-Schultz is Southwest Regional Director of the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. Tiffany, thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Good afternoon.
Give us a sense of the scope of this problem.
Well, we see scams 10 times a day. I mean, we're all targeted. We're targeted by email. We're targeted by phone calls, which you're probably very aware of. That's where the majority of them come from. We're targeted by text messages. We're targeted by pop-up ads. And everybody that you know has been targeted by a scam. However, today we're talking more specifically about senior scams. Seniors are very vulnerable to those scams.
And why are seniors so particularly vulnerable?
Well, there's a variety of reasons why they're vulnerable. Typically, seniors are very polite. They don't want to be rude. So when a scammer calls, they're going to take that call rather than just hang up on them. Most people think that they have more assets, that they're just a very vulnerable population. So, they're just very vulnerable.
We may get to a point in the future where seniors have used technology through a large portion of their life. But right now, it also seems that maybe seniors might be a little less tech savvy and a little less tech literate. And that, I'm guessing, could feed into this as well.
Right. Absolutely. And scammers know that seniors, they want to communicate with their grandchildren and their children who are very involved with social media through text, the texting platforms, through the social media platforms, email platforms. They want to be involved in their lives. So that's another avenue for the scammer to go ahead and target the senior.
So we talked about phone scams, and those can be pretty convincing for any of us, but certainly especially for seniors. How do you differentiate between scams and legitimate calls?
A scam will always have a piece of information that makes it seem real. However, there should be red flags that go off depending on what type of scam you're looking for. I want to bring into the equation imposter scams. And I'll share a situation that happened with me. And I'm a consumer. I'm not a senior. We're all consumers and we all get hit with scams. But recently my health insurance changed to Humana. And I got a phone call from a scammer. It was during the week, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They called me from an 888 number saying, "Hi, this is Humana, your health insurance company. We have some important information for you. Please call us back 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And here's your special 7-digit code to call us back." So the red flags there were, yes, Humana is my new health insurance company, but what insurance company is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
We wish they were, right?
Right. They called from an 888 number that was very similar to the number on the back of my card to call the customer service number.
And 888 is toll free. But I'm guessing that information was probably not correct.
Right. It was very similar, but it was not the same phone number. And it gave me a 7-digit code. Your health insurance company will never give you a 7-digit code. So there were pieces of information in there that made you think. And usually that's how a scam call is going to work. There's going to be a piece of information in there that seems real, but there's going to be other pieces of information, like the phone call that we had heard. The scammer was very broken English. That should be a red flag right there. Mm-hmm. Just listen to the call. Start asking questions. Typically, you shouldn't even take the phone call. Just don't answer or hang up on them. But if you do take the call, be very, very careful. And don't think that you can take on the scammer, because these scammers are professionals. And sometimes you think you're taking them on and they end up threatening you at the end of the call. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Tiffany Schultz. She is the Southwest Regional Director of the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. We're talking about the hundreds of millions of dollars that elderly people in Wisconsin are being scammed out of. Now, we've talked about a few ways that someone who's actually receiving the call or the email, one of the things with emails is that you can hover over the address to see where it's really coming from. And often right away you can tell that's not coming from Humana or some legitimate business.
Right. It'll be a weird email address that it's coming from. We've been seeing more and more business email compromise scam emails where it looks like it's coming from somebody legitimate, but if you really look at it, it's not. Never click on a link that's in an email. Never click on a pop-up ad. Sometimes if you click on those, that can go to a scammer who puts malware on your computer to gain access to it. And then once they have access to your computer, they can get access to all your financial information if you used online sites for banking and online purchasing.
So it sounds like being more suspicious than we maybe wish we needed to be is kind of a good rule
right.
to follow.
Be extremely careful when you're shopping online as well. You can always check out free business profiles at BBB.org too. Do your research on a company or a link anytime that you're out there doing business with somebody. You want to make sure that it is legitimate.
So what actions should grown children of seniors take to help their parents? Maybe their parents are hearing this, but maybe they're not. What's the best way to pass information along or share resources with?
Educate. Don't answer phone numbers you don't know. If it's important enough, it will go to email or email or voicemail. You want to take the time to report those calls too. And you can do that at bbb.org/scam tracker. And it takes you through the process. Any information that you can give us is great because then we get out there and we can warn others about it.
So that's bbb.org/scam tracker.
Scam tracker. Yes.
Probably easier to type than to say. Well, and that gets to something. A lot of people really, really want to see scammers brought to justice. How difficult is it, not to discourage people from reporting, of course, but I know that there are some big hurdles to being able to catch and prosecute people.
Right. And the more information we have, the better. So what really is important is taking the time to report that scam. Whether you're reporting it to BBB.org, you're reporting it to the local police department, you're reporting it to the FTC, you're reporting it to DATCP. Report those scams because our education, our outreach will lessen those scams. There's always going to be something that probably takes its place, but the more educated we are, the more the scammer's not going to get the best of us.
And I have seen sites where, like, you can plug in a phone number. Like, if you get a call from a number, you can plug it in, and sometimes it will tell you, like, likely scam. Are those pretty reliable as well, just to check things out?
Do your research on them before you go ahead and do it. The best thing that you can do is report the phone number to us, and then we can take the investigation and go from there.
Is there anything in the works on the state or federal level that will help crack down on crime like this?
We're always trying to work with the other agencies and law enforcement to shut these down. So there's work going on behind the scenes, and being a smart consumer is another way to shut these scams down as well. Don't fall for what they're trying to sell you or trying to scam you out of.
So keep an eye on emails that we're getting, especially if they're links or things to download. Keep an eye on phone calls, texts, in the mail as well?
Mail, pop-up ads on your computer as well. You've probably seen it where there's like an antivirus that pops up and it's not legitimate, but people think that it is when they say your computer is at risk. Before you click on anything, do your research.
Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the information.
Thanks for having me.
Tiffany Schultz is the Southwest Regional Director of the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. She joined us to talk about the different ways that seniors are targeted with scams. In Wisconsin, seniors are losing millions of dollars each year to scammers. Monday at 3, we'll be talking about new inductees to the Video Game Hall of Fame. This year's additions are Colossal Cave Adventure, Microsoft Solitaire, Mortal Kombat, and Super Mario Kart. quite a variety. We know that video games inspire a lot of loyalty from the people who play them, so we want to know which games you think deserve that recognition. Call our toll-free Ideas Network comment line at 833-42-IDEAS and tell us what video game stands out to you, whether it's from your childhood or one you play today. Tell us what you love about it, what makes it better than the rest, or if you've got a tip for new players. And if you have feelings, good or bad, about those four new inductees, you can share that too. That's 833-42-IDEAS. 833-42-IDEAS or 833-424-3327. Let us know what you think, and we may use it on the air on Monday. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then some residents in southwestern Wisconsin are questioning the need for dozens of new cell phone towers. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.